Today we do mitzvot and halakha. Now you can sit there, download for a while. I'm going to be talking for about the next hour, and then we're going to do a passage of the Zohar.
Don't you always do that?
What?
It's not an hour.
Yeah. Sometimes the download is heavier than others.
Zip format.
Right, the zip format. Okay, what is the relationship of halakha to Kabbalah? Okay, this is going to be theme and variations in which we're going to talk about ritual, then Tamei HaMitzvot, then Shalom's theories, then probably what is. So first of all, Gershom Shalom assumed that Rabbinic Judaism was about obedience. And in his essay on ritual in the Kabbalah, he writes explicitly that Kabbalah was the animating myth of Judaism. Kabbalah and Halakha are very different realms, but for Gershom Shalom, without Kabbalah, you would have no reason to do Halakha. Because since Halakha is completely devoid of any reason, myth, or justification, then therefore Kabbalah has to be it. He said, some points in other books, he says that Rabbinic Judaism was still tied to our original Rabbinic inspiration, but then was removed from it, and afterwards Kabbalah was the vitalizing factor. For Gershom Shalom, philosophy intrinsically is not a motivating factor for keeping of mitzvot. His model here is German philosophy of someone like Hermann Cohen, a rationalization that if your whole goal was to be rational and ethical, then there's really no reason for Arbor Minim. The details of ritual only make sense when you have a complex myth to explain it. He assumes that Samson Raphael Hirsch's definition of Rabbinic Judaism is Judaism. He doesn't argue with it, meaning he basically says whatever the Orthodox say are correct. Gershom Shalom himself briefly went through a phase when he had Orthodox Talmud teachers. Gershom Shalom's contemporaries, like the Talmud professor Ephraim Orbach, assumed some sort of Hirschian position. And Gershom Shalom shares the critique of Hirsch that's found in Franz Rosenzweig and Rav Kook, that the halakha of Hirsch is much too this worldly. You've given up the eternity for the sake of this world. And where it becomes a major point in Rav Kook and Rosenzweig, Shalom just takes that as a given that we've got to turn back to Kabbalah. Now this tension that it's Kabbalah versus halakha colors everything he wrote, and very important for a place like YU, it colors the writings of the Jewish historian Jacob Katz, who assumed that everything was Kabbalah versus Halakha, and that Kabbalah is some sort of addition to the Halakha. And Jacob Katz will then document how in the 13th, 16th, or 19th century Kabbalah is imposing or not imposing itself on the halakha.
Was that to do with YU?
Because here we tend to assume that Kabbalah is something separate. Now, Yisrael Tashma put out a book called Hanigla Shebenistar. Hanigla Shebenistar. Yisrael Tashma.
What does that mean?
That's his name. Well, it's the name he took when he came to Israel. His brother took the name Mishnayot. The things you get to do when you made Aliyah in the 50s. It is the reveal that's in the hidden. And he writes in this book that all halakha in the Zohar comes from Ashkenaz Kadum, from ancient Ashkenaz sources, whether Agadot, Midrashim, or early Ashkenaz, other Ashkenaz sources. And Tashma makes a major leap because he shows that the majority came from Ashkenaz. He then wants to claim that all of them must have come from Ashkenaz, even if we don't have the sources anymore. So, for example, covering Chalot Friday night has Midrashic origins that are taken as normative in Ashkenaz, that it's Zecher Laman. Kabbalah certainly picked that up, but they didn't make it up. Or the idea of Neshami Yisera, which is mentioned in Rashi, so mentioned in the Gemara, developed in Debei Rashi. And then when Kabbalah makes a whole issue about you getting a new soul on Shabbat, it's continuing a theme that is already there in the Debei Rashi.
Just very quickly, when he says Kabbalah, he's referring to the Zohar and the text for all.
He's talking here about Zohar.
Just Zohar.
Yeah.
Not like the Arim or Amos, Zohar. Okay.
Now, when the Kabbalah came to Tzvat, it became publicized, and the Zohar gets published and widespread due to Tzvat. All those customs were in the Zohar, but that doesn't mean that they're brand new customs. A lot of the customs were accepted because they are Ashkenazi customs. Meaning, the fact that Neshama Yisera made sense is because you already had a cryptic Gemara and a Rashi to deal with. It's not that it was a new idea. Or the fact that the Ari says you should put on both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam Tfillin, that was the Psak of the Rush. It now just gains an extra imprimatur, an extra gushpanka of the Ari. But that doesn't mean the Ari made it up. Or the fact that when the Minhagim of Tzvat spread all the Jewish communities, it doesn't mean they accepted it because it was Kabbalah. And a lot, you have to really take it on a micro level for each Minhag. Why is it being taken? And a lot of times the reasons for being taken is because there's a prior Minhag or text or something that it's already playing into that gives it an extra imprimatur.
He saw mostly Ashkenazi halacha, or he saw
the
Zohar mostly Ashkenazi halacha, or
an
Ashkenazi culture.
Ashkenazi practice. I mean, part of Tashma's bigger thesis is that a lot of what Ashkenazi practice was went back to Agadah and to Minhag Kadum and wasn't all found in the Bavli. Now, when you ask about how the ritual spread, Moshe Chalamish has a very large book called Kabbalah Minhag Halacha, like a 1,000-page book. But he traces, it's like a 17-chapter book, and he traces about 15 minhagim, how they spread. Not like you would think, oh, it spread from the Ari to the Magen Avraham to, you know, a certain Sidur. For a given Minhag, he could list, depending on the chapter, 300 to 700 different Sidurim, Nuschaot, Kihilot, that you really have to figure out how it spread. Meaning, if there's a Tzvat custom, Chalamish really went town by town, you know, through Turkey, through Italy, through Germany, through Poland, through every Sidur and edition and Sefer Minhagim to see the patterns of its spreading, what led to its spreading, what encouraged it, what held it back. So that it's not just in big, ways that you'll say, well, Kabbalah affected Halakha and everyone in the 17th century started thinking Kabbalistically. The answer is no. There are a lot of very clear micro changes and clear decisions and how you go from in Kabbalat Shabbat from the 1530s to then being published, in 1610 in Italy as a nice family ritual, L'chadodi and Eshet Chayel and all that, and then being picked up for more family reasons, and then how each thing spread, depending on its version, was slightly different for the minhag, for the country, for the ritual of what was there. There is a side debate that goes on between Chalamish and Reuben Kimmelman from Brandeis, where Chalamish assumes, and we'll speak about Minhagei Tzvat or Minhagei Kabbalah, and he will separate out a given Minhag and then see who adopted it. He will never let you ask the genetic question of where it really came from, whether it was Ramak, whether it was Are, who is it? Reuben Kimmelman, in contrast, will let you say this is a Cordovero minhag of Kabbalat Shabbat, this is an Ari minhag, this is an Azikri minhag, and how they then got combined or didn't get combined is its own separate question. And hold off on that; that will play itself out in a minute.
So, should be some origins?
Yeah. So it's Gershon Shalom, and Katz, who assume it's halacha versus Kabbalah. The current state of the field is much more complex. Let me now go through half a dozen examples. First, Tikkun Chatzot. You get up in the night and do a ritual. What do? After the Churban, there were many groups in the first century into the Middle Ages that did various forms of Tikkun Chatzot. Karaites used to get up in the middle of the night, among others, Avlei Tzion. The Zohar discusses getting up at Palgalelia to be with the Shechina. Does that mean you're getting up then to study Torah or Kabbalah? Does it mean that you're getting up at that point to have marital relations with your wife? Does it mean you're doing the Lurianic Tikkun Chatzot formula? Meaning, the fact that there is such a model of getting up in the middle of the night is not just, the question is not just, because the Ari created Tikkun Chatzot. A lot of Kehilot had all sorts of prior midnight rituals that this played into. So when it comes to Italy, it's going to take on Italian dimensions. For example, Elliot Horowitz, in an article in the AJS Review on coffee and coffee houses in Italy. Now that you laugh, but this is important. Shows that where Gershon Shalom makes broad generalizations about how Kabbalah affects ritual, Elliot Horowitz shows that in the 17th century, where Kabbalistic rituals originally meant getting up at Chatzot, after the rise of coffee and coffee houses, it meant staying up late. So even if you're doing it, doing a ritual, it's not all the same. Different groups will do things in quite different ways. And to this day, I don't know if you've ever done slichot, in the beginning of Elul with, one of a Turkish or Libyan kehila, they're brewing coffee, in the middle of the night, and part of brewing coffee is
slichot.
Yeah. You're done?
No, but I'm never
brewing
coffee before. I've never seen that.
Oh, you see, there you go. They used to be part of the thing.
I had somebody like that in Iran.
Okay.
That home, like, yeah, like, eat, it did, like, you know, have a, like, you know, like, huh? Yeah. And then like an hour after 4 days to be eating before, and then they would say Slichot, and then they'd go.
Right, in my time it was still like that for many of the Eidot in Yerushalayim. But that's very important. Don't make one-to-one correspondences. Oh, I have a Ramak or Ari Minhag, therefore it's all the same. Every Eidah played it out with its own sense of eating, drinking, timetable. Let's go to another case, Kabbalat Shabbat. The Gemara says that they would go out and greet the Shabbat and say Bowie Shabbat Kala Bowie Shabbat Malkata, would go out and greet the Shabbat. Now as a side point, you should know that both Rashi and Rambam make in the Shabbat HaMelech treated as male.
Who is that?
Rashi and Rambam.
Yes.
And the Rambam in the last parak of Hilchot Shabbat. But the Zohar, with its developed images of the Shekhinah, makes Friday night into a wedding imagery, not just going out to greet Shabbat the king. And this practice of Kabbalat Shabbat, there's one version that was already started by the Alkabet Circle, Shlomo Alkabet, the author of the Hilchot Dodi, in Andrea Paul and Saloniki. They moved to Tzvat.
He was a Kabbalist.
Yeah.
He wrote it in the Tzvat,
right? No, he wrote it in... Yeah. A lot of their activities were done pre their getting to Tzvat. And in the Cordovero circle, the Alkabet, the older brother-in-law of Cordovero, you would sing Lecha Dodi. You would say six psalms in honor of the 6 days of the week. Creation is complete. And you would do it inside. I mean, in Beit Knesset. In contrast, Luria did not sing Lecha Dodi. Luria went out into the field. He, with the Chevraya, closed his eyes, meditated on the Anabakoach, the Shem Membet, because that was the name of the power of creation. So what happens is, part of the Lurianic meditation service, which was done outside, and the Cordovero singing of Lecha Dodi, which is done inside, was combined into our Kabbalat Shabbat. The first version of our Kabbalat Shabbat was not by Ramak or Ari, but was Moshe ben Makir, who is over on Har Zayit, a few hills over from Tzvat, and from there it spread to Italy, and between 1650 and 1815 it spread to every Jewish community in the world, the last to be the Rhineland Basin that accepted Kabbalat Shabbat around 1815. Hold on. But the truth is, Ramak nor Ari ever did our version of Kabbalat Shabbat. Now for Ramak, Friday night was a wedding. And so you're going to think about various rituals that relate to the Zohar wedding passage. And there are alternate nuschaot of Lecha Dodi, some much longer. Some including Matan Torah, Bria Matan Torah, Mashiach, meaning there are longer theological versions. We do a very short non-theological Nusach of Lecha Dodi. There's a nice article by Yosef Kohen in his collected studies dealing with the history of the Nuschaot of Kabbalat Shabbat. On the other hand, Luria was not dancing around like a wedding. Luria would mandate that he and all his students dressed in white, like a Kohen, having at least 4 big day kahuna in white, and that they would make the entire evening into a very solemn priestly event, in which everything you did was to be like a Kohen Gadol. You wore white, you ate at a 4-legged table to be like a mizbeach. You use 12 loaves to be like the lechem upon him. But that wasn't Ramah. Now, and part of it is the combination of various aspects of what both groups did and what some other groups did also created our version. Now, Reuben Kimmelman, in his recent book, Kabbalat Shabbat, asks why did Kabbalat Shabbat survive till today, while most other minhagim of Tzvat not. They did lots of rituals. Why did this one survive? I told you there was some sort of minhag of going out to greet, buying hadasim, but not as our version, no. And he says, I mean, Kimmelman's basic answer why Kabbalat Shabbat caught on is because people liked it. Because it was ambiguous to be the imagery between both husband and wife and Kabbalistic. Unlike all the rituals, Tikkun Leil, Hoshana Rabbah, or Shovavim Tat, or any of these other things which had less of an attraction, or even to really do Tikkun Leil Shavuot, where you really do the Tikkun and you don't just get up and have Shirim all night, but to really do it formally. Part of the attraction here was the fact that everything in Kabbalat Shabbat, in the Nuscha Ot that eventually won out, had the ambiguity of being making sense on the level of Nigla, making sense on the non-Kabbalistic level, and playing into home life. So it's not that Kabbalah took over, it's a Kabbalah-inspired practice, as it is then toned down, that took over. Okay, now, yes.
Is it possible because that was in the Gemara, so
that
people felt more
based
and older?
No, because a lot of the others are better in the Gemara also. I can go through a lot of other Minhagim Mitzvot that did not catch on. You know, you can go through, the basic works, whether you go through Seder Hayom and Moshe Ibn Makir, or the Keturah Da'aba, or the Chemdat Hayamim, all these books that list lots of Minhagei Tzvat, you'll see how many we don't do. Yes? But the answer is, why do you have now, German communities in the Rhineland picking it up? Why do you have Jews in Yemen, Baghdad? Why did everyone pick up some Hilcha Dozi?
As opposed to show the other things?
Yeah, a lot of the others were not all picked up. Okay, now pick up. There are others that. And the answer is because this one worked on the Nigla level also. Let's go through another one. Women not drinking Havdalah wine.
I heard some weird thing about that.
Well, let me get to that.
Sorry.
That was an ancient Ashkenaz practice, that women should not drink the wine of Havdalah, because Havdalah wine undoes the Chet Adam HaRishon, undoes Adam's sin, and since women were responsible for the sin, they shouldn't drink it. Okay? This is not in 13th century Kabbalah. It is not in the Zohar. But what happens is that in the 17th and 18th centuries in Eastern Europe, the demonology of Lilith, which is only seen as a mythic temptress, we'll talk about that in two classes, it was only seen as a mythic temptress, will be applied to all women. The Shla in the 17th century, Yeshaya Horowitz, says that all women are Lilith. and therefore all women should have nothing to do with anything corrective or anything that undoes Chet Adam HaRishon. Here's an example. Can everyone quiet down? Of a practice that was ancient Ashkenaz, in no way coming from Kabbalah, but in the 17th century, it became linked with the demonology of the Kabbalah. I mean, the idea of Lilit got tacked on to an Ashkenaz minhag. And then when the Magen Avraham and Mishnah Berurah call it a minhag Kabbalah, you've got to look back and say, no, there's no Kabbalist that really did this. This is an Ashkenaz minhag being explained using Kabbalistic terminology. That's one of his innovations.
That's a completely innovation of
Shlug. Of his time period. To further demonologize women within 17th century Ashkenaz culture. But it's not technically Kabbalah. You'll not find it in the Zohar or of Israel or in the Ramach. Let's take another example. Shir Shel Pigaim, saying Vayihi Noam, whenever you want to ward off evil or when you enter into the week. That's explicitly in Gemara Shavuot. I don't need anything Kabbalistic whatsoever for that. It's an explicit Gemara that says Shir Shel Pigaim, Vayihi Noam, wards off Mazikin. But then once that becomes a widespread way of warding off Mazikin, it then also becomes associated in people's minds with Kabbalah. And then a lot of Kabbalists will then use it within their own ritual creativity. Let's continue. Shavuot. Something tells me Daf Tedvav. I haven't Chazak. It's Shavuot. For some reason, Tedvav or Zion, I just don't have a... Remember, it's in the very beginning. It's just whatever you're doing very quickly in the beginning of the Masechet, and you get to it, and you go, oh. Now, with the widespread rise of the printing press and various broadsides coming out from Tzvat, other things spread all around Jewry, whether Tikkun Leil Shavuot, Hoshana Rabbah, Tikkun Chatzot, Kabbalat Shabbat. Each one has their own separate story of how it was used, adapted, played out. Once again, Tikkun Chatzot in some place where you're getting up at 3 in the morning and drinking coffee around the fire is very different than a country like Italy where Tikkun Chatzot can be a cantata that you stay up and perform after Chatzot. Important for sorting out, one more thing for sorting out the role of halakha, and this applies mainly to those of Eastern European descent in this room, is that in the 17th century, there are a number of works that will apply Kabbalah to the Siddur. Most importantly, the Shari Tzion of Natan Hanover, and the Shla also, but the Shari Tzion especially, that will externalize Safed Kabbalah, that no longer is it experiential, but externalized. Let me explain. So examples of experiential would be Kabbalat Shabbat, you sing, or Shavuot, you stay up all night. The 17th century Ashkenaz was into internal... externalization. Examples. Our Seder plate is now 10 svirot. The fact that you have six pockets and three matzot, and you must have a ka'ara, is 10 svirot. That's an externalization. According to Dina de Gemara, or the minhag of the gra. The only thing is, you know, the mitzvot should be closer to you. There's no specific need for a ka'ara. You can put the zroa and beitza wherever you want them. That clear making a tenfold pattern on the table is a 17th century practice, as is hiding 10 pieces of chametz to find the 10 during bedika chametz. Other examples of this, I mean, just to know how much they changed our Sidur, the Shari Tzion is the one responsible for putting in all of our L'shem Yichud Kutsha Brichu V'shchintes. No longer are you meditating on how to bring down Bracha from Arek Anpin to Zer Anpin to Nukva, or specific meditations on Sfirot, how to do a Rikuz Machshava, an ascent, the Veikut in the Shariora form of ascending to Bina. You now have an external recitation of saying L'shem Yichud Kutsha Brichu V'shchinte, and it's no longer a meditation. The Shari Tzion is responsible for most of the Hinini Muchanim Zumans, is responsible for, let's say, some other things, Pritkiyat Shofar, the fact that we do seven times L'matzeach, followed by Kara Satan. What? Yeah, that's not in prior Sidurim. It's responsible for doing all the Psukim during Birchat Kohanim. All those Hefsek Psukim are from Shari Tzion. It's responsible for the longer opening of the Aron on Yom Tov, the Hashem Hashem Bakasha on Yantif. Yeah. Is what?
You wrote the
Sin? Nathan Hanover. Also wrote the Yain Mitsula. So a lot of these quote-unquote additions to the Sidur are not being made by 13th century Kabbalists or Tzvat Kabbalists or even true Hasidic Rebbes and Misnaget Kabbalists, but this now became the folk Sidur of Eastern Europe to have all these additions to it. Yes?
What was the Sfari rule? Like, I mean, I like how Sfari, a lot of things you mentioned, you have to do is the...
It wound up, each Edah has their own equivalent version of it. I mean, that's why if you were doing a comparative Sidur, as a test case, you would use something like the Ben Ish Chai, which has all the Kabbalistic minhagim that were floating around, but with his personal imprimatur about which ones he thinks are correct. But he also he still has a lot more of the meditation ones in his. So when you buy a Ben Ish Chai Sidur, know that there's a pop version and there's a heavy duty version with all the meditations. Buy the heavy duty one. I don't know if they have different names, but you go into the right Mocher Svarim and you ask, no, that, not that one, the full one. And you'll likely be invited out for coffee or something afterwards also.
You got a handle on a Sephardic Sidur with the 1300s.
Hmm?
If you got your hands on the Sephardic Sidur, let's say the
1300s.
We have those. And they're lacking all these
things. They're lacking all of them. They're not in the Ramat Sidur either. Or the Ari's Sidur. Schloss Sidur is one of the generators of this material.
The Rishash Sidur.
Huh? The Rishash Sidur as Sidur does not have them. The Rishash Sidur that you may buy in the 20th century will have them. That's not the same thing. Meaning, a lot of times a Perush will be put around a Sidur that was not the original Sidur. What? The Yehudim, yeah. But whatever you want to call it, but it's not necessarily the exact nusach of the original figure. That's why a lot of times you'll have to go back and buy a special Sidur, which was the one that figure actually used. There's a lot of, meaning which one? The red one? The three volume? There's a lot of new ones.
Hmm? white and has like a blue.
Yeah, the pretty color one is a great one for the Kavanot. I never checked the Matbeah Tefillah in there, only because that's not why you're buying that one. Meaning what the actual, you know, nusach they're following in there. Usually these things tend to update them, not what the original person prayed. Okay. Let me continue. Gershon Scholem did not distinguish between Kabbalah, folklore, popular customs. He blurs the lines between all of them. Because if your categories are Kabbalah, philosophy, or halakha, anything that's not halakha and philosophy, ipso facto, becomes the animating myth of Judaism, which is Kabbalah. So a lot of popular customs that are out there, even if they've now taken on Kabbalistic language, doesn't mean that there was a Kabbalist overseeing them. So too, another example, if Eastern European tombstones or sukkah decorations in the 17th century were Kabbalistic, that doesn't mean they're following any particular Kabbalist.
That doesn't mean they're not necessarily Kabbalistic though, right?
Hmm?
I mean, for example, we have many customs in the Torah that everybody might give a reason, or the Torah might give a very deep sort of reason for doing a particular mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
But that reason always applied, we just happen to not know what it was. So we might have a lot of ritual that might trace back before all these other people fall into. So saying, man, trace back to the Ari, the Ramah, but is it still possible because something Kabbalistic?
Okay, so thank you. That's one of the things we're going to get to in 10 minutes from now. 13th century Kabbalah is about Taimei HaMitzvot of the ordinary mitzvot and halakha. It is not extra practices that are externalized or recitations. It's more 17th, 18th century Kabbalah that is brand new practices. Meaning not wearing tefillin and chol hamoed is an actual machloket. Not to do it was already the shita of many gaonim. And the fact that the Kabbalah decided that way, that's not a new practice. That's already taking a clear side in a debate. That's an omission. If we're then talking about a particular practice, for example, doing na'anuim, if the Gemara has only doing one single holich v'hevi, one single action, someplace by the time we get to the 12th century, there is the custom of doing it the six directions all around you, for the six directions of space. And then once again, when that now comes in all the literature of the 13th century, or gets quoted as halacha afterwards, that's our very definition of how to do it from late antiquity. Man, I don't know, I've never met anyone who's been machped to follow the Gemara and do a single holich v'hevi without doing the other five directions. Now watch, I'm going to walk out of this room and I'm going to find somewhere. Okay. Bigger problem. Gershon Scholem has a grand theory that all Kabbalah was antinomian. Antinomian means against the law. Yeah. That there's a true antinomian element within the Kabbalah. And hold off on your questions while I explain this fully, because this will affect your reading of Gershon Scholem. In the Tikkuni Zohar, there is a distinction between Torah Habriyah and Torah Atzilut. Torah Habriyah, the Torah of creation, is the Torah of this world, halakha and mitzvot. Torah Atzilut is the Torah of emanation. It's seen as higher. It's the messianic Torah. Tikkuni Zohar attacks those who limit themselves to halakha and don't partake of nistar. Gershon Scholem reads the Tikkuni Zohar in a very sharp anti-halachic reading. Gershon Scholem continues his narrative by turning to Chaim Vital in his introduction to the Ari Shar HaHakdamot. And this Hakdamot also gets reprinted in the beginning of the Eitz Chaim and a few other Laurianic works, where Chaim Vital says the ultimate meaning of all mitzvot is Kabbalah, not Halacha. And that the reason why we do mitzvot is not because of the Bavli, but because of the Kabbalah. Kabbalah overrides Halacha. Gershon Scholem makes the statement of Chaim Vital paradigmatic of the entire Kabbalistic process. Despite the fact that figures like Jigatila, Cordovero, the Gra, were entirely halachic and would never agree that Kabbalah overrides the Bavli. Gershon Scholem, in his writings to create this antinomian Torah Atzilut, combines that statement with statements from the Psikta about how in the Messianic age the Chazir will be Chozer to us and become kosher again. Implying that what is Usser will eventually become Mutar. Gershon Scholem goes from Tikkuni Zohar, even though it's different than the Zohar, says because of Chaim Vital's introduction it represents Luria, and then eventually shows that all Kabbalah points to Sabbatianism.
This is
Scholem. Kabbalah is naturally antinomian for Gershon Scholem. Mitzvah haba be'avera, matir isurim. And Gershon Scholem then takes it further in his own bigger vision, as therefore Sabbatianism being the origin of Hasidism, the Reform movement, and modern Zionism. Because if Sabbatianism taught you you can do God's will without mitzvot, and Hasidut showed you this dveikut that's higher than just obedience, Reform and Zionism are also showing you how to sanctify the everyday outside of the old mitzvot system. Now this is a pillar of Gershon Scholem's thinking. Needless to say, it's controversial, but it was a big part of his worldview. And I repeat, it's important to point out that Tikkuni Zohar does not represent the mainstream of Kabbalah. In Svat, Rav Yosef Karo and the Ramak and others are all quite halachic. And Vital is not the only statement that comes out of Svat. But an example of where it does play itself out, a certain debate from this morning, is, for example, in Chabad. Chabad has statements like, if you come late, you don't skip to do the Amidah with the congregation. You do it in the correct order, even if you're davening basically be a chidus, because it's important to go through the four worlds properly. That's clearly against the Gemara. But it doesn't matter because there's a higher principle of going through four worlds. Or when Chabad says that we don't sleep in the sukkah anymore because the sukkah is so holy, the Gilui Shechina. Once again, that line of reasoning is now creating a new line of reasoning beyond the specific halachic texts. It's not antinomian like Gershon Scholem thought, but it's allowing Kabbalah to play an equal role to halacha. The phrase that most people use for that today, and came up this morning in the Chabad conference, was neo-nomos. Not antinomian, they're not against the law, but neo-nomos, that there can be new laws or new principles. That the halachic system is not closed, and just as in early Ashkenaz it was open to a Gothic influence, So too, in a post-Svat world, Chabad or the Ben Ish Chai can base themselves on Kabbalah as a neo-nomos, a new law, not that they're against the halakha, an antinomian position. Yes? How does it? Because here it's you're still keeping to the basic system.
Like, for example, quote the Arizal, you say when you're washing your hands, you hold the pill in your right hand, fill in your right hand, pass it to your left, wash your right hand first. And
you're supposed to do if you're supposed to finish within a specific amount of time that if you don't because of a certain reason, like going through the four worlds.
Because it's basically introducing another. It's as if introducing an Im Tomar that you want to daven on a certain level of kavana, and you have a fixed sidur Yesh Lomar that only applies for certain cases, and this case is slightly different. It's in some way entering into the debate, even if it's a. What?
Another variable.
It's an entering into new variables, and that's why the phrase that people use is neo-nomos. Yes?
Those aren't really striking examples. Most people aren't sleeping in the sukkah anyway at all, and you can daven in the sukkah without.
Did I say they're striking examples? I didn't say they're striking, but know that the critics out there will.
So not great. They're minor benefits.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
It's not really a lot.
No, it is. I mean, it is, because the truth is it's still putting in a certain calculus about how to decide things in our Chaim, and basically not saying that the Kabbalah is only an addition, or just letting you choose between Shittot. It's an actual factor that you're going to factor into what you're doing.
So where's the lack between that and,
Where's
the lack between that and there's a higher principle?
Because this is not higher principles, it's already reproducing a specific hierarchical capitalistic world. So that's why it already has a very clear sense of closure. You already know where you're winding up before you start. To say there are four worlds and everything we're going to do is the four worlds of the ten spherot, it's not really open to what's meaningful or relevant to us. It's already a continuous pattern of modeling and, imposing fours and tens on the Gemara that may have never been there.
So you want to do a use of male dominating and female dominating?
I don't know. I'm not sure I would have a clear idea what that would mean.
What is
the answer is if that was the construct that you could some way fit in, then the answer is yes. Then that would be a route to go in. And that becomes back, we can go full circle, is that even as Shai pointed out, these are minor things, or they are all within the system, there still is that pregnant opening for that rupture that is there. Not as much as Shalom wanted to point out, but it is there. So that pregnant opening, people today were calling neo-nomos.
You wouldn't call the church.
No, that is clearly antinomian in the Buberian sense. I mean, it's clearly being moved and not feeling any binding, rather than saying there's a specific rutz on Hashem for something to be arranged a different way. Yes?
So let's go back to Shalom's examples, I guess. Say that Kabbalah is antinomian. It was the Tikkunim, instead of the Torah, the Torah, the Tzivut.
Yes.
A person should delve just towards the Tzivut, or is it superior?
Yeah, in his reading.
In his reading, or is that what it says explicitly?
It's Chaim Vital kind of implies that you should be doing Nistar and not Nigla. But the Tikkuni Zohar, in a more sensitive read, is not really saying that.
So it's really Shalom's read on the Tikkuni.
Right.
And also, he said that it's similar to Shabtaism and Chassidut, etc., that he quotes things like, Chazer will be closer, and but even that itself is implying that in the future it will be closer.
But if you're a Sebastian, it's now Reshit Smichat Gulatena.
But I'm saying the Ari seemingly kept Halacha, who Right. That he was out there saying Matir Asurim and having orgy.
Right. Well, that was part of Yeshua Shalom also collapses Jacob Frank, the false Messiah, into the more halachic Shabtai Tzvi, into the completely halachic Luria, as if Jacob Frank's Matir Isurim is the same as Shabtai Tzvi. The difference is, let's go through it. The Ari was completely halachic. Yeah. Shabtai Tzvi did things like pronounce Shem Chavaya like Abulafia, or he would celebrate all Shlosh Regalim in a week. What?
Or convert to Islam.
But he wasn't, there was a point that he was still playing with the traditional categories. Unlike Jacob Frank, who said everything that used to be forbidden is now mutter, and therefore everything that used to be karet, like incest and chelev and dam, is now a chiyuv. Gershon Shalom will use Jacob Frank as the model to understand Shabtai Tzvi, and Shabtai Tzvi is the model to understand the Ari, and the Ari is the model to understand Tikkuni Zohar, and then all of this is a model to understand all Kabbalah.
I'm just trying to understand this, so that Shalom, who believes that Kabbalah is against Kabbalah, that's one against the other, right? And I'm assuming you knew who the Ari or knew who some of his works, and the Ari was clearly the Kabbalah, not anybody who debates that. I mean, he's clearly the Kabbalah. So how do you understand the Ari? practice of halacha.
I don't think he ever thought in those terms.
He used
Vital, and he never went much beyond that.
So how do you understand how Vital said? Like any known mystic who kept halacha,
he would see Chaim Vital as already being a perfect setup for the Sabbateans to exist. That he didn't really know what he was saying, and the Sabbateans drew the correct conclusion.
So Chaim Vital believed in understanding the Kabbalah correctly, and Shabtai Tzvi did?
Yeah.
And that's why Shabtai Tzvi
was Shabtai
Tzvi only
understood
Vital.
No.
That he drew the correct.
Halacha on the other.
Yeah.
Shabtai Tzvi's breaking from that, and he's really keeping Kabbalah correctly.
That's correct.
I'm saying, so you would really say that they're being Chaim Vital, even though they're mystics, didn't truly understand Kabbalah correctly. Shabtai Tzvi, who broke.
They understood it correctly, they just didn't draw the next implication.
Yeah. Okay.
He's at the end of his chapter on the Ari, he has this incredible line, you know, like, but Luria never drew the full implications of his theory. And with that, we will turn to Shabtai. He has some, like, great line, like, yeah, he has some, like, great line like that. Very sharp and terse. Okay. Now to Taimei HaMitzvot. In actuality, the majority of Kabbalistic works from the 13th century are works of Taimei HaMitzvot. Shalom was more interested in Svirot than Taimei HaMitzvot. More interested in myth than in the actual life of the synagogue or the practice of Judaism. Gershon Shalom had little interest in synagogue life and ritual. That is one of the innovations in Tishbi's volume, that he adds ritual and mitzvot back into the study of Kabbalah. Moshe Idel, in his book New Perspectives, pointed out that most 13th century manuscripts of Kabbalah deal with Taimei HaMitzvot. He points out how the Zohar thinks mitzvot affect the universe parallel to our own. Idel also points out how many mitzvot augment God, meaning they give power or koach to God. You know, the Yehashmei Rabba Mavarach, as explained by Machzor Vitri, that may God's name be increased or magnified, he shows is all over rabbinic literature. There's what?
In this world or in general?
In general, and there's a new book by Yoni Garb that really brings out this theurgic, this element of augmenting God. Idel points out that there are also traditions that we coronate God. You know, that we put the crown on God's head, and that mitzvot serve that function. And Hazel creates a somewhat of a neologism in Jewish studies. He creates the new word theurgy. It's originally meant within Neoplatonic thinkers like Iamblichus that certain magical rites will affect henads within the Godhead. Hazel will use that term and apply it to Kabbalah and say Kabbalistic ritual is theurgy because you are affecting the divine. Rituals are needed in order to affect the divine. After he finished New Perspectives, most of his writings, Hazel's articles on Tamei Hitzfeld, dealt with this theurgic element. Now, in terms of the actual Tamei HaMitzvot, the most important work is Reb Ezra of Gerona, a work that is reprinted and copied often. It is available in Kitvei Ramban under the Ramban's name as the Perish on Shir HaShirim. Most of Kitvei Ramban is not by the Ramban. In fact, very little, almost nothing in there is. Almost everything in those volumes is by other people. That in
the Ramban,
that's from Ezra. The real Ramban on Sefer Yetzirah is in Kiryat Sefer, Volume Vav.
Oh, okay.
From the 30s. Why Chevel put the wrong things in there leaves many of us forever perplexed why he could be so sloppy. What? That is the Masada Rav Kook, yeah.
Yes. So Ezra Verona is really the Ramban's parish and share sharing?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's...
He studied Ezra?
No, they have nothing to do with each other. They're just that Chevel did such a sloppy job, he put lots of things under the Ramban's name.
That's crazy.
Let me get to what he's, okay, so the Reb Ezra on Sefer HaMitzvot is published, the most accessible way you can get it is in the Kitvei Ramban as the Perish of Shir HaShirim, but no, there's an English translation by Seth Brody in the library, or if you want, because Seth Brody died young, it's available like for only $8 or $10 on Amazon because the publishing company just discontinued it. Because in the end, you know, you wind up when he died in his 30s, so unfortunately, they became, you don't footnote to people who, you know, just wound up being not a basic source and never got pushed or anything. So from a work record of Ezra, you have basic Tamei HaMitzvot, basic Hanhagot. The most famous is binding the Arba Minim together that they should touch, which gets cited by the Beis Yosef, and it becomes basic Halacha. Brody, in his introduction and in his separate article that it's on my suggested reading list, distinguishes between two types of Tamei HaMitzvot in early Kabbalah. Those Tamei HaMitzvot in Gerona, in which the goal is to make an ascent and to reunite the ten Sfirot. Mitzvot are for the purpose of bringing down Bracha or to bind oneself to Chachma. That will be in Ezra, Rav Israel, or more importantly, we see the influence of Gerona on the Sharei Orah of Jikatila. The goal is to connect oneself into the Sphirotic realm, mentally, versus the Tamei HaMitzvot from Castile, figures like Achim HaKohanim, Moshe Gilyon, and parts of the Zohar, in which the Tamei HaMitzvot, the goal is to unify Tferet and Malchut, or to unify Tferet Malchut with Bina, or to unify Bina and Chachma, or to ward off the evil side. So where for Gerona, Tamei HaMitzvot is really mentally entering into the divine in order to bring down blessing, Within Castile, most Tamei HaMitzvot is to perform a yichud, to perform a unity, to unify a part of the divine, or to ward off the evil side. Brody brings out an important point that will help you when you read Kabbalah on Tamei HaMitzvot. Kabbalists use the Mikdash as their model, and Kohanim as their model. So Kabbalists do not really have a category of Shogeg. Like, there's no Shogeg in Mikdash. Can someone help me unpack? We have the Kudshim learner here. In Kudshim, there's no Mazid Shogeg distinction. Okay? Introduction to Zvachim. Someday you'll get... You never got there. Okay. So, what? No Shogeg in Kudshim. Kabbalists work the same way. And when Kabbalists say everything needs to be done in the Shema, they tend to think more in the Kudshim way, that everything has to be done as a certain pu'ula for a certain purpose, not just L'shem Mitzvah, but for clearly for the name of the Zevach and the Zoveach and the clear requirements of Kudshim. They really do. Well, that's what it's going to lead into. They really do think in those terms. That is, if all the mitzvot we do are having profound effects. Now, in the passages of the Zohar that we did, I'm going back to the original Idel point of mitzvot in the Zohar. First, you understand we live in parallel worlds, the Kigavna factor, what I call the harmony. Then the importance of gestures, whether putting out the setting the table or putting out the chalot, or inviting Ushpizin. And then is the actual bringing down blessing in the performance. During a mitzvah in the Zohar, what's important is not thinking about the Kabbalah, but doing it correctly. So to give you a classic example, Kiddush Koshel Bracha. The idea is kegavna, just like what's above is what's below. There's a flow up above between the sefirot. There is a flow coming down to our world, just like up above the right. The left should be incorporated in the right, and the right should be the proper hand. So too down below, the right should take precedence over the left. And when you hold a koshel bracha, you hold it in the palm of your hand. Because the same way Malchut is surrounded and protected on all sides, so too your cup is surrounded on all sides by your fingers. So you have a harmony, you have a gesture to hold the cup a certain way, and the performance is not to be thinking about the Sfira of Malchut when you're doing Kiddush, but to actually be thinking about the Shefa and the Brach of Shem Membet. Because that's what's coming down.
So without thinking about it, it will still be proper thing if you follow the action.
That's correct. For the average performer, for our performance, yes. For Jikatila, no.
Who's the first category?
Which? For the average, whether we're thinking Ketan Paz or Nefesh Chaim or anyone. The performance is what counts more. Yeah. What? Yeah, the Gra is like that.
It's scientific.
This is.
Look, whether you know what you're taking or not, you're taking the vitamins to affect your body a certain way. If you're going to poison, it's going to kill you. The spiritual reality is just as real as physical reality. So if you hold the cup a certain way, that's going to have an effect on the spirit, whether you know it or not.
So within this model, everything has to be performed correctly. There are other rituals that do require meditation. And it's important to separate out which ones those are. For example, tefillah, according to the Shariara or Cordovera. Unlike, for example, Nefesh HaChayim and the Gra, in which even though they require kavanot for Yechidei Skula, for the average person, there are deep sodot that Anshei Knesset Gedolah put into tefillah, and therefore the very recitation of the liturgy is sufficient.
That's for the Gra, right?
Yeah. But for others, you must have kavanah. We have enough time to do one more thing, which is in now the Zohar on Sukkah. Okay, quickly pass these out so we can have the shleimut for this class. Which?
So it's like for tefillah, we have the Gra that you really need kavanah, but even if you don't, it's
you need one more?
Put in very, very deep sodot. So saying the Gra and Chaim Balad and Shaim on the one hand, and so who holds that you must have tefillah is Shariora.
Shariora, Ramak, and I'm not shortage of figures on the other side either. Okay, skipping over the whole pasuk, we're now in Danny Matt, guests in the sukkah, 148-149. We started about 4 minutes late, so we'll have enough, just enough time to finish this. Rabbi Lazar opens. So once again, the Pakach language. Thus said Yud, K, Vav, and K. I remember the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride, how you followed me in the wilderness in a land unsown. So it quotes God said, Zacharti lach chesed nerayach. This verse refers to the communion of Israel, when she was walking in the wilderness along with Israel. I remember the devotion, this is the cloud of Aharon, which floated along with five others, all bound to you, shining with you, your love as a bride. They decorated, crowned, arrayed you like a bride bedeckled with jewels. Why all this? Because you followed me into the wilderness in a land unsown. So Rabbi Lazar takes the pasuk about going into the midbar. We know from Midrash and the Gemara that the sukkah corresponds to the Anane HaKavod. The Zohar extends it and says, Knesset Yisrael, the Shekhinah, was with Klal Yisrael in the midbar. Not only that, the Anane HaKavod was really the six Svirot, Chesed, Gvura, Tferet, Netzach, Hod, Yisod, who also were shining into Knesset Yisrael. So when you followed me into the Midbar, I came with you as Tferet and Malchut. I came with you as the lower seven Svirot, with you into the desert. So the sukkah is going to stand for the Anane HaKavod. The Anane HaKavod is the seven lower Svirot. Hold on. Come and see. Don't ask me questions. Look at this. When one sits in this dwelling, the shade of faith, Shekhinah spreads her wings over him from above. Abraham and five other righteous heroes come to dwell with him. Rav Abba said, Abraham, five righteous heroes, and King David dwell with him. As it's written, 7 days dwell in the sukkah. 7 days, as it says, for 7 days. Similarly, it's written, 6 days Yukevavke made heaven. Day after day, one should rejoice with a radiant face, along with these guests who abide with him. And Rav Abba said, it is written, 7 days dwell in the sukkah, then shall dwell in Sukkot. First well, then shall dwell. The first is for guests, the second is for human beings. Okay, we've said that sukkah, that when they went through the desert, they were there with Shekhinah and Tferet, or the seven lower Sfirot. We now expand it and personify it, that these are the seven heroes, the seven Rishpizen, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, David, We then, as we've seen before, the 7 days, time equals space. The 7 days of creation, the 7 days of Sukkot correspond to the 7 spherotic levels. And therefore, you should be rejoicing in a radiant face, the same way they did in the desert. They were all shining from glory to glory. They were all shining in the desert. You should be shining too. So the first is the guest. What makes a sukkah is the fact of the parallelism that your sukkah is the indwelling of these higher 7 spherot, and then you should have guests down below. Now we have Rav Hamnuna Saba enter the picture. The first is for the guests, because Rav Hamnuna Saba, upon entering the sukkah, used to stand in joy inside the opening and say, "Let us invite the guests." So the phrase Azmin l'sudasi is from Rav Hamnuna Saba. The custom of inviting ushpizin into the sukkah is from the Zohar, and it's from a statement of Rav Hamnuna Saba. Rav Hamnuna Saba is the one introducing this gesture. He would set the table. So it's Rav Hamnuna Saba giving us a gesture. He would stand erect. He would recite the blessing and say, 7 days dwell in the Sukkot. Sit down, sublime guests, have a seat. Sit down, guests of faith, and have a seat. So all these Sukkot gestures of Azmin l'sudasi ushpizin ilai is Rav Hamnuna Saba's gestures. First you learn the parallelism and the harmony. Rav Hamnuna Saba tells you to do gestures. Raising his hands in joy, he would say, "Happy is our portion, happy is the portion of Israel, as it's written, the portion of Yud Kei Vav Kei is his people." Then he would sit down. Okay, that's the higher guests. The second for human beings, one who has a portion among the holy people and in the holy land, sits in the shade of faith to welcome the guests, to rejoice in this world and the world that is coming. Nevertheless, he must make the poor happy. Why? Because the portion of those guests whom he has invited belongs to the poor. One who sits in the shade of faith and invites these sublime guests of faith and does not give them their portion, all of them rise to leave, saying, "Do not eat the food of a stingy person." It turns out that the table he sets is his own, not divine. Of him it's written, "I will spread dung upon their faces, the dung of festal offerings." Your festal offerings, not mine. Woe to that human being when these guests of faith rise to leave the table. The Zohar is giving you a second gesture, hachnasat orchim. If you don't have guests in the sukkah, now once again, the Zohar is not making up some wild Kabbalistic custom. But the point is, unlike the 17th century that made up rituals that were quote unquote Kabbalistic to the naked eye, here the Kabbalistic ritual is to do hachnasat orchim in the sukkah, and woe to you if you don't do it. And Abba said, all the days of his life, Abraham used to stand at the crossroads to invite guests and set a table for them. Now that he is invited along with all those righteous heroes and King David too, and they're not given their portion, Abraham rises from the table and calls out, "Move away from the tents of these wicked people." I'm not going to go through all the variants, but if you don't have guests in your sukkah, these patriarchs leave. So it's not, you know, shame yichud kushbrichel v'shchinte. It's not some externalization. No, the very basic halachic structures are seen as having great import. Rav Elazar said, Torah does not demand of a person more than he can do, as it's written, each according to what he can give. But a person should not say, first I will have my fill with food and drink, what is left I will give to the poor. No, the prime portion belongs to the guests. If he makes the guest happy and full, the Holy One rejoices with him. Abraham calls out, then you will delight in your kevavke. Okay, so making the guest poor, your human guests stand for the supernal guests. And now Rav Shimon comes and concludes this. he gets always the punchline, and with this we'll conclude. This verse is said by King David, because all weapons of the king and all battles of the king have been handed over to David. What Isaac says is, his seed will be powerful on earth, wealth and riches in his house. Jacob says, then your light will burst through like the dawn. The other righteous heroes say, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei will guide you always and satisfy. King David says, no weapon formed against you will succeed, for he has been appointed over all weapons of the world. The true answer that Rav Shimon gives is now the blessing you will receive. If you have this glowing face and invite the guests and make them happy, you will have the wealth, the riches, the light, and more importantly, you will have this blessing of being invincible, whatever this power of David is, whether you're a Chabadnik and see it's a messianic power, and you speak in that terms, or you're more of a Svarti Mekubal who thinks in more talisman magic terms, you will now have the power of David if you do this correctly. Okay? Today was on ritual. We'll continue a little bit more on that, and then we go into the dark side next class.